Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we continue our visit to Canada's Outdoor Farm Show, where Country Guide reporter Ralph Pierce spoke to Jason DeVoe from the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs about how to chop the time it takes to clean out your sprayer. There's lots of excitement and debate about the federal government's plans to legalize recreational marijuana. But Health Canada has been licensing the production of marijuana for medicinal purposes for years. This year, Canada's Outdoor Farm Show featured a one-stop shop of exhibitors that you'll have to work with if you want to get a production license. Plus, Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather Information, takes a look at the markets. All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Gord Gilmore.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. We're joined now by Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Weather and Markets, for the latest from the grain markets and some production numbers. Bruce, glad you're here.
Nice to be here.
So, Statistics Canada released new crop estimates for the 2017 crop. What did the report tell us?
Well, as expected, the numbers increased. The yields, certainly as we've gone through harvest, have gone up. We're seeing a fairly dramatic increase in some commodities, virtually all of them did go up except for flax, which declined slightly in this report. It wasn't unexpected, although this is a different type of report the Statistics Canada is releasing. It's not based on a farmer survey, but on some of their work that they've done on remote sensing over the years. So it's really taking that remotely sensed data and converting that into yield potential. So it's slightly different, but we did see the biggest increase in the Durham yield numbers. They're up about 10% to over 31 bushels per acre. Again, this is significantly below the long-term average. So certainly, again, it's not a bumper yield by any means. Canola was up 8% to 38.1 bushels per acre, which is basically sort of like an average yield that we've seen over the past, let's say, 5 years. At the top end, but certainly more or less average. And spring wheat was up about 6.3% to 47 bushels per acre. The number that sort of steps out here is the canola number. It's gives us about a 19.7 million ton crop if it is realized. So that is a record. So it is going to change the canola markets a little bit. Again, our concerns earlier on in the year was what we produced is basically going to limit the amount of demand that we can satisfy. Right now, if we would use the same types of usage rates as we did last year, the carryouts still increased just slightly based on these numbers. Not anything worrying about price-wise in terms of being so burdensome that prices are going to be going downward rapidly, but certainly something that's a change from what we've seen, let's say, over the past 2 months.
It sort of, in my mind, would almost sort of cap the upside potential of the market. Is that a fair way of looking at it?
I would say it does to some extent on the canola side, at least anyway. Of course, we're going to take directions from the international oilseed markets, and we have a lot of important information yet to ascertain about the U.S. Soybean crop, as well as how plantings in South America are going to go over the next few months. But for right now, at least anyway, the potential of rallying canola because there isn't enough supply looks to be out of the picture.
And I'd like to just back you up a little bit, if I could, to a comment you made in your first response, and that you were talking about the difference in this report. And I'm just having a little trouble maybe personally getting my head around it. You say remote sensing. So what is that? Is that satellite sensing?
It's satellite images that Statistics Canada has used, certainly been available from Statistics Canada over the past 10 or 15 years. But 3 years ago, they decided to take the numbers from these reports and put them into actual an actual report in terms of yields. So that's what's happened here. So no farmers were surveyed, and we won't see a farmer survey until the November numbers are released in early December.
And your sense as somebody who's been following this this development over the years, is it more or less accurate than a farmer survey? Do we have any sense of that?
I would say it's different than a farmer survey. Both survey types would have errors. But again, you have to remember the July numbers that were released last month were based on people talking to farmers, asking them what the yields were. This is essentially taking satellite data and trying to calculate what kind of yields resulted from that.
Moving on, let's talk a little bit about the weather. The U.S. agency, the NOAA, released an update on the South Pacific Ocean temperatures last week, and they say there's potential for La Nina to form in the region over the next few months. What's that going to mean for us, or do we know yet?
Well, certainly they increase the probabilities of us being in a La Nina, which essentially is colder temperatures in the equatorial Pacific region during the winter months here. So that probability is increased to just over 50%. So again, it's not absolute that it's going to happen, but it looks like that's the trend right now. And I think for Western Canada, that immediately goes to our winter weather. Unfortunately, in Western Canada, that is not a positive development for us. We tend, especially in the northern grain belt and the eastern side of the prairies, to have a much nastier winter in La Nina years. A lot more snow, a lot more cold temperatures, and a longer winter in general. So not great news for Western Canada in the upcoming winter season, but certainly I guess we're forewarned about it. And if it turns out better than that because La Nina doesn't develop or because of some other atmospheric factors, then we'll take it. But be prepared again for maybe a more typical prairie winter this year.
And is there any holdover into the growing season from these, or do we have any kind of clear correlation?
There aren't a lot of clear correlations. I think the one hopeful development from this is that we tend to get heavier snowfall. And in those areas that haven't recovered soil moisture from this year's drought, especially in some of the southern areas, this winter precipitation may be critical for next year's crop and getting it established. The other impact of this, of course, is not necessarily in Western Canada, but on international areas. The one that's probably chief of mind right now in the corn and soybean markets is Brazil. During the winter months in Brazil, it tends to get a little bit wetter, especially up in these new growing areas up in the north. So you could look for some harvest problems with the soybean crop. Unfortunately, that would mean that they would have plenty of moisture for the corn that goes in right after it. But certainly that's a potential worry right now. The other thing is Australia is suffering through a fairly significant drought right now. And during a La Nina, they would expect to improve their moisture conditions. So for next year's crop, not this year's crop, but next year's crop, they might have a little bit better start to their season if the La Nina does develop.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot depending on that word if, though.
Yeah, most certainly, like 55% flipping a coin, half a chance of having a La Nina, half a chance of not.
Right, so not quite time to be alarmed, but be prepared.
Be prepared, yeah. Yes.
Now, just to close up, I'd like you to talk a little bit, if you could, about the dollar. I've been hearing some crazy forecasts of par dollar and some of the alarming effects that could have. What's your feeling on that? Are you skeptical of it?
Yeah, I'm very skeptical that we would be able to get to par here, at least within the near-term future. And one of the reasons is basically that all areas of Canada still aren't performing to their economic capacity, let's say. It would take oil moving up into that $80, $90 a barrel range to get the economies in Western Canada going to the point where we're seeing that they're going to move along rapidly and would cause the rapid appreciation of the dollar. The other concern that I would have about this is that the increased value of the dollar already is moving back the export sector in terms of its ability to compete. And not only in agriculture are we going to be impacted by the stronger dollar, making our products a little less competitive, but also in the manufacturing sector and lumber and all these other export-dependent industries that help drive the Canadian economy. The one thing to note, though, and I just caution about the stronger dollar, the Canadian dollar has increased about increased about 15% from the lows that we set about 3-4 years ago. The U.S. dollar at the same time, though, has dropped about 10%. So realistically, if you look at it that way, the Canadian dollar has appreciated about 5% relative to the U.S. The rest of it has been based on weakness in the U.S. dollar. What happens with a weak U.S. dollar? That increases the prices for commodities. In fact, I think we're seeing it right now in the corn and soybean markets where we've driven commodity prices low, plus the weak U.S. dollar is resulting in some very strong demand for both commodities as we move into the harvest season.
Well, demand is good, but the dollar will affect profitability, though, I guess, is really the math of this. Eh?
Well, that's right. But if you take a look at it, if we do get stronger markets due to the lower U.S. dollar, that does help offset somewhat that price. So, really, yes, there is a penalty. We'd like to see a lower Canadian dollar, at the same time a weaker U.S. dollar, and that would increase commodity prices in general. But we always can have our cake and eat it too.
Thanks, Bruce. That was Bruce Burnett, who joined us to talk about weather and markets. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Up next will be Ralph Pierce to tell us a little bit about the latest in how to rinse sprayers properly to avoid drift. Sprayer drift and sprayer residues have become a hot topic in farming recently because of the damage caused when susceptible fields are accidentally treated with products such as dicamba and 2,4-D. Farmers attending Canada's Outdoor Farm Show in Woodstock, Ontario, saw how they can significantly reduce the time it takes to clean out their sprayers before moving on to the next job. Country Guide reporter Ralph Pierce spoke to Jason DeVoe from Ontario's Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs about the advantages of continuous rinsing versus the old triple rinse approach.
Here with Jason DeVoe talking about the importance of continuous rinse, triple rinse. That's still the message that we need to hammer home.
Yeah, it's a distasteful process and it's important, and those two things mean that this argument will never go away. But that argument was taken away from a lot of European sprayers where legislation in several European countries came down that they weren't allowed to leave a field until their sprayer was 1 or 2% of the original tank concentration as sampled at the nozzle. And recognizing that even a conventional triple rinse can take 20, 30 minutes, that adds a lot of time onto somebody's day when they have to be clean coming out of every single field before they can go back on the road. So we needed a solution.
And you come up with one.
No, I have glibly stolen one. Ag engineers in Europe recognize the issue, and it's that a sprayer, most sprayers, have one single pump. And that pump does double duty. It can either spray out of the boom, or it can circulate spray, or it can draw water from a clean water tank. It has difficulty doing all these things at the same time. So the way a conventional triple rinse works is you have so many gallons of spray mix left in the lines, left in the sump, or if your math wasn't good, even left in the tank. And you introduce one-third of the clean water you're carrying using the main pump through the rinse-down nozzle, and you add clean to dirty and get slightly less dirty water. That's a dilution. Then you circulate that through the system as best you can. Then you climb back up into the cab and you spray it out the boom. But again, you've left 5, 10, 15 gallons of now more dilute spray mix behind. So you climb back down, introduce the next third, do it again. Now, the power of serial dilution is that every time you add an additional small volume, the amount of original pesticide left gets considerably lower. But the question becomes, when are you confident? When have you used enough water? We already know using a lot of water isn't the answer. Using multiple individual rinses does a much better job. But we still have to get in and out of the cab. It's still a 30-minute process. I'd like to see guys rinse out their sprayer at the end of every spray day, even if they're going in the next day with the same product, which I'll never get that Christmas wish, because, like I said, distasteful. But I think it's important because hydrating that residue, preventing it from drying out, soaking in, means that when they have to inevitably do a huge cleanout, it'll be much easier. So let's go back to Europe. Their solution was to add a dedicated clean water pump. This low-volume pump, all it does is draw clean water from the tank and introduce it to the rinse-down nozzles directly. It bypasses all the plumbing. It bypasses the main pump. The main pump can then be used to continually spray. What this means is your sprayer gurgles because it's empty. You flip a switch in the cab, and now clean water starts to get introduced to the tank and displaces dirty water rather than dilutes it. So you're pushing spray mix out from behind rather than adding clean water to it. The upshot is you can get down to the same 1% or 2%. It's as good as the triple rinse in a fraction of the time. Let's say it took 30 minutes to clean the sprayer with a triple rinse. Now you can do it in 10. Best of all, you never left the cab, so operator exposure is nil, and you sprayed that rinse aid out over the field where it can break down naturally.
So, again, we're not going to solve this problem, but this is an effective way, more effective way of dealing with it.
I think anything that reduces operator exposure, spreads the residue out so it can break down rather than having point source contamination that is dumping in the same spot over and over again, and making the cleanout easier because of all these serial rinses, how can that be a bad thing? We've worked with HJV, and they've converted a Rogator to this system for, I think it was about $1,500, and most of that was just figuring out how to do it. And we've recently started working with Greenlee, and I'm looking right now at a Case IH 440 Patriot, 4440, and we've outfitted it with a continuous rinse system for, I think it was $2,500. Now, that may seem like a lot, but when you consider that it does such a wonderful job in a fraction of the time, you add up the man hours and it makes it worth its weight in gold. I would like to see North America adopt this before we're forced to adopt it the way they had to do in Europe.
That was the Country Guide's Ralph Pierce with Jason DeVoe from the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture. Up next is John Gregg to talk a little bit about the exciting opportunities in medical marijuana. There's lots of excitement and debate about the federal government's plans to legalize recreational marijuana. But Health Canada has been licensing the production of marijuana for medicinal purposes for years. Some see this as an opportunity for rural entrepreneurs who don't mind taking farming inside. This year's Canada Outdoor Farm Show featured a one-stop shop of exhibitors that medical marijuana growers will have to work with if they want to get the license. Glacier Farm Media's John Gregg spoke with Jamie Cooper, who operates GHC Safety and Security Solutions, a security company that specializes in agriculture operations.
Jamie, can you tell me, how did you come to be here and what is your business's interest in being part of this exposition?
We're a longtime exhibitor at the show here, and we're also own a security company. We deal in all kinds of security for agriculture, food production, petroleum, pharmaceutical, and now medical marijuana production. And we were talking with the show president, Doug Wagner, earlier this year, looking for some new exhibitors and suggested we bring a showcase in this. We believe that agriculture can benefit greatly from this, as this is a way to return money back into rural areas. The significant amount of returns that a grower can get is 1,000 times more than what they can get for current agricultural crops, returns per acre. And of course they need to have security, and we're very much involved in that. We have a number of producers that we're working with and that are getting their licenses. It's a really unique business because it brings knowledge that farmers have acquired all those different years, dealing with financial matters, dealing with employees, dealing with crops and pesticides and fungicides. It's just a different crop.
And what would that look like on a farm?
Typically, it's going to be either in a greenhouse or it's going to be in a big block building, such as a big driving shed. We have someone who's in here this morning that has two hog barns. They want to look at repurposing, and they probably will work, so they won't have to go to the capital cost of building a building. Basically, it's something that could be a controlled environment, 365 days a year to grow medical marijuana production plants.
So what sort of costs are involved in starting up something like this for a farm in Ontario?
Basically, the initial investment is probably about what it would be for a dairy barn with robotic milkers. But the difference is that you can get your money back in 6 months, and you can double your money in 12 months.
So this sounds really I think there's a fantastic opportunity. Farmers are well known for filling a needed market very quickly. Think of hemp in the way, the amount of hemp that ended up in people's sheds. Do you have any concerns about overfilling it?
It's all licensed by Health Canada, so it's just not something someone can just jump into tomorrow. There's quite a process to go through that, consulting that we're involved with, and engineering and finding a suitable process and stuff. So given the amount of red tape and stuff that's involved in making one of these facilities actually happen, no, it's something that's going to be there for mainstream for a long time. And, you know, will there be market saturation? I can't predict that. But from what people we talk to, they don't see it for 20-plus years.
So what would the process be a farmer should do if they have some interest in medical marijuana?
There's a company called Mallet Creek that we work closely with. They're the main consulting engineers. And you would contact someone like them because they can do the process from start to finish, writing the application, and even sourcing the properties. We have a place today that they're just working on closing a deal on for production. And they do everything to find the grower.
That was Jamie Cooper with GHC Safety and Security Solutions. Although the potential revenue is attractive, this isn't an easy business to break into. John also spoke with producer Chris LeBunk about the process.
Chris, tell me about your involvement with medical marijuana.
Well, my current position now is master grower for Alterna Medicinals, and we're going to be a licensed producer of medical marijuana, and I will be growing and running the operation.
Right. And you were a traditional farmer. Tell me about what you did grow and how you made the journey to growing medical marijuana.
Okay, so I do farm greenhouse tomatoes, I farm kale, I farm organic garlic, and I was approached by a person that was a sick person who asked me to help them grow medical marijuana for themselves, and since then I've taken on various patients and have been asked to come and take on a larger project.
Right. And tell me about that licensing process. What does it involve?
It involves lots. Basically, we have to build the entire facility, have the facility up and running, all the security done before Health Canada will issue us a license to cultivate, and then we get issued a license to sell.
So you have to build the building and everything ready before they'll even give you a license.
Everything, right? Security, everything.
Right. Yeah. Right. And how long is that process?
Right now we're in about 3 years, but currently Health Canada is speeding that up, so it'll probably be about a year for everybody else.
Okay. And what will your facility look like if someone is driving by?
It'll look just like a closed box warehouse building. It'll be simply just an office with a warehouse in the back with the plants growing.
Do you have any concerns with a lot of farmers coming into this market and flooding the market?
No, I don't, because I think it's going to be a huge market. I don't think we know exactly how big it's really going to be.
That was medical marijuana farmer Chris LeBlanc talking to Glacier Farm Media's John Gregg. You're listening to Between the Rows, and that's all the time we have this week. I'm your host, Gordon Gilmore, saying goodbye and be safe out there.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.